Hi, my name's John Carosella, and I'm your host for Convergence on Firefly Willows LIVE. Convergence is to consciousness as gravity is to the material world. In small amounts, gravity is overwhelmed by every other fundamental force of the universe. But gravity has something nothing else has. It's cumulative. The more matter you collect, the more gravity you get, until it becomes the most powerful force of the material world. I think convergence is like that too. Only in this case, we're working with truth. The more truth we collect, the more convergence we experience. Connections, relationships, resonance of ideas and concepts, science and mysticism. Lately, deep truths just seem to be coming together, even as many of the illusions around us are falling apart. As within, so without. As above, so below. I know I'm feeling it, and I'll bet you are too. For the next 90 minutes, we'll be exploring concepts and topics that in some way or another bring us around to a deeper truth. Join me and my guests for this week's experience of Convergence. Hi, welcome everybody. We are back in the Firefly Willows Roundtable in Studio C. My name is John Carosella, and I'm here with my co-hosts Deb, Mildred Lynn, and Hi C.
Good morning.
So, welcome.
Hello.
Back.
Hello.
Hi, John.
Today's topic is resistance. Every day we face resistance in achieving our goals, yes?
Yes.
Everything from, I was going to go running today, but I decided to stay in bed. Going to watch TV, maybe I shouldn't watch TV, but I watched an extra hour anyway. Or I'm supposed to clean the fish tank, but I can wait another day, you know. What is this stuff that is resistance, and why does it have strength? Why does it have power in our worlds? If the things that we set out to do to achieve our goals are good for us, why don't we do them? Why is resistance in the way? And what is it? What is the nature of resistance?
Well, I found it interesting the way you ask when you say every day we face resistance, and yet in the examples you gave, the resistance is self-made. It's not something that we're facing. There isn't something that is somehow causing resistance for us to be able to clean the fish tank or to not go running. It's us creating that resistance to it. So it's, and it makes me think, like, a lot of times I always make people change the way they say things. And so, you know, I'll always hear from people, like, if it's, say, to start doing meditation regularly. So, oh, yeah, I would love to do that, but I just don't have the time. And I'll say, well, first of all, we're going to change what you just said, because we all have the same amount of time. It's just what we choose to do with that time. So we have to make the time to do something. So therefore, I'm fabricating the resistance by telling myself I don't have time, rather than seeing that there is nothing really standing in my way to do it other than me being willing to do it.
So why do we fabricate it?
I'd say from a life coaching model that there could potentially be something that you're more committed to than taking that particular action.
Oh, so is there an example?
Yeah, sure. So I might be wanting to improve my healthy eating habits by preparing nice healthy foods, but I might be more committed to my comfort and convenience.
Ah, okay. So
that's the underlying level to that. So really when you're looking at, you know, I'm not eating healthy, the opportunity is there to reflect back and say, well, wow, I really would like to be healthy, but for some reason I'm not taking the steps to be healthy in terms of eating. So that must mean there's something up there higher on the priority list. And mm-hmm. if you can identify what's higher on the priority list, then you probably have something to work with.
So I really like that idea, Mildred Lynn, that there's something higher on the scale, because I find that it's easier when I experience the resistance that I generate for myself, it's easier for me to see what I am doing than what I'm not doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other point, too, is, you know, some people may feel, make it mean something about themselves if they procrastinate or don't make a healthy choice. And what I would suggest, and I use this myself, is really courting the ability to laugh at yourself. So if you're procrastinating or you're not doing something that you view would be in your highest good, if you say some non-life-affirming dialogue like, oh, I'm no good or I never get this right, just to step back and to laugh at yourself a little bit and practice changing that vibration into something that's life-supporting.
So what? How do you laugh at yourself when you're mad at yourself?
Well, maybe you catch yourself before you get to the stage where you're mad. So a lot of people have benefited from, you don't get mad all of a sudden. There are certain things that usually are in place before you get to the state of being mad. So the trick is to step back and identify and observe yourself. Observe first when you're walking down that path of judging yourself and getting mad, catching yourself there. And at that point, you're able to take it a little bit more lightly. So that would be, and that's something that I found personally that's worked really well for me. And today I was joking and someone said something to me and I said, you know, it's really hard to insult me because I just assume everything is a compliment.
That's a handy answer. Maybe also changing some wording, like I think that we get a little stuck because a lot of times, like when you were saying about eating healthy, I think that a lot of times what people will do is say something like, I should be eating more healthy. And as soon as we hear that word should, that's where we create resistance because a lot of people I think have a built-in conditioning to, well, I'm not going to do what somebody else tells me to do. For whatever reason, that has become their conditioning in their life. And if we can change that, even using the word need sometimes is more important than should because need creates a certain urgency. So it's like saying, you know, I need to clean the fish tank because I have people coming over tonight for dinner.
Right.
We've made it a priority and created an urgency saying, I just have to do it. Even though it's not something I want to do, it's something that I need to do and just has to get done, so I just do it. You can also use want in there, but I think when you hear yourself saying need versus want, it starts to prioritize and it says, I want to do this, but maybe that means it's something I'd like to do, but it's not overly important to me or it's not extremely urgent right now. So maybe it is something that I will do, but when we say need, it says, no, this has to be done. And should puts us into this mindset of feeling as if somebody else is imposing it on us or something else.
I resonate very strongly with that, what Heisey just said. I do not like should at all. I am the kind of person that does not do well with the someone has told me I need to do something and that then there's a certain expectation about how I act or what I do or what I choose and I don't respond well to that. I don't like a well you should be doing it's like why should I be doing anything that any you know
who are you?
Exactly. Excuse me, no, I should not be. But yes, of course, one should look both ways before crossing the road. Okay, that's kind of a given. But if I choose not to and I get hit by a bus, well, I got hit by a bus and I learned. But so the should do is not a easy or a good mindset to come into something with, especially if you are dealing with or aware of resistance in your life, self-imposed or self-generated resistance. And I also agree that with what Mildred said very, very early on in our conversation, there is always something behind the why am I not doing, you know, I want to make more healthy choices in my eating patterns. Well, that means a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, grabbing a cookie out of the cupboard and walking out the door with it in your hand while you're in between the thousands of things you need to do in your day is so much easier than being prepared or having something more healthful or something that you need to go to the refrigerator and actually open the refrigerator up and take something out and then you have dishes and or perhaps cutlery that you have to then take care of. Grabbing that cookie, besides the fact that, yay, cookies, is just infinitely simpler.
So in a way it disturbs your flow less to be less considered about your choices.
Exactly. The resistance to the changes that one feels one wants to make in one's life is habit. And finding a way to step outside of the habit that you are familiar with, that you're comfortable with, the flow that you have created, and finding a new habit, a new flow that works just as readily as the one that you're used to.
Yeah. And I think we have to be careful not to be a reinforcer of resistance for others. Because, again, if we take the word should,
mm-hmm.
don't, you know, check and look and see how often you tend to either think or say to somebody else, you know, you should really... So, like, if somebody saw you taking that cookie,
mm-hmm.
if somebody else was always saying, you know, you really shouldn't be eating that cookie, you should be eating something healthier,
mm-hmm.
that can actually reinforce the resistance because they're going to dig in their heels a little more.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're going to hear that every time in their head, but what they're hearing is not themselves telling themselves, I should eat healthier. They're going to hear another voice of somebody else saying, I should be eating healthier, and therefore I'm not going to do it because I'm going to push back
right.
against being told what to do.
They hear a criticism as opposed to an encouragement.
Right. And they, mm-hmm. and then we can't distinguish in our head whose voice we're hearing say
mm-hmm.
should, and even though it really is us saying, I know that I need to eat healthier, we're hearing somebody else that has been critical in saying, I should eat healthier.
So it feels like a wound every time we play that tape.
Right.
Yeah, that's not good.
And we have to look at that in ourselves, but then also look at, am I somehow contributing to that for somebody else through the words that I use? So maybe I have to look at not using the word should so often. So I'm not reinforcing that or creating internal resistance for somebody later.
The other thing I find really comical is that people feel or they think that whenever they decide to make a change or shift, such as eating healthier, that automatically the body and everything else and their life and their support structures will fall in place to support that. And what they don't realize is that their body, their life, their thinking process has supported the old habit, and it's going to take some time
mm-hmm.
and a few steps and some management to grow, like a garden, a new habit or pattern that may be healthier. One great thing I learned when I was living in the Gatineau Hills is that head time and body time, it's like they're in two different time zones.
Explain that a little bit.
Well, I learned this from naturopathic medicine. We're so used to taking an aspirin or something and we get better in 20 minutes. And when you're exposed to a naturopathic model, which works with your body at the pace of your body, it's on a different time schedule and usually takes a little bit longer, but in the process you are being retrained and your body is being retrained.
Right, so it's not a symptomatic relief, it's actually rewiring.
Yeah. So one day I was sitting there looking at the beautiful trees in the Gatineau and I realized, hey, my head is telling me one thing, it's in one time zone, and my body is telling me a different message. And then I had to make the choice. Am I going to go with my head, which would have made me frustrated at the how quickly I was recovering, you know, wasn't quick enough, or was I going to relax into my body and use nature as my guide? And I chose to use nature as my guide, and everything went along splendidly, and I retrained myself.
Mm.
So it was a huge lesson. It was a comical lesson, too, because I had a great expression on my face when I had that realization. I think my eyes both cried.
Well, but I think it's a symptom of our society. We're very instant gratification oriented.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm going to make a change, then I need to see the results of it tomorrow. So
mm-hmm.
I need to start going to the gym. Therefore, I sign up and I start going to the gym, and I've been there three times this week, and I'm in total pain, and yet I'm seeing no difference in my body. Well, obviously it's not working, so I'm giving up.
That's
Ooh.
Right.
And the naturopathic
mm-hmm.
approach says the body knows what process it needs to go through to make true change, and we have to learn to come back to allowing that process, even if it's not in our head's timetable.
Right.
And not create the resistance. Again, I think that becomes self-generated resistance because we're saying it should happen overnight. And when it doesn't, there's a problem or it's not working, which is really us saying that versus my body is experiencing benefit from the three times I've been to the gym this week. But I'm not seeing that and I'm creating the resistance because it's not the kind of change or the speed of change that I had envisioned for myself happening.
Mm. One of the things that there was a little phrase that I heard that I really like, and I repeat to myself at various moments, and that is, I don't have to do the dishes, I get to do the dishes. And it seems funny and odd, but if you take, first of all, it allows you to think of all the blessings that you have in your life. I mean, I think, well, I get to do the dishes. What does that mean? That means I have a dishwasher, and I have nice dishes, and I have an abundance of cutlery that, you know, I mean, like, I have this stuff, and that's really nice. And when the dishes are done, they're going to be clean, and when I open the dishwasher, it's going to, everything, you know, it's going to be steam, and, it, you know, there are, in most every moment, in every chore, there is some gift, right? There's some benefit, and when I shift from, oh, geez, I have to do this, to I get to do this, it puts me in a place of gratitude, a feeling of being blessed, and then I get to have fun and look forward to the parts of that activity that actually can be fun. And that helps me overcome resistance, too, when I do that.
Good point. Mm-hmm. What's the little phrase again?
I don't have to do the dishes.
I get to
do the dishes.
Nice.
And it turns it into a privilege.
Mm. Cool.
So I guess that's a good spot for us to wrap. Thanks for joining us for this week's Firefly Willows Roundtable.
And where are we?
We're in Studio C.
And we'll be back?
We'll be back next week.
Coming up, John will take us on a journey exploring reality under a full moon. Then, he'll have a spirited conversation with Ana Maria Sanchez, author of Girl from the Hood, Gone Good. And later in the program, we'll explore one of the Norse runes, an ancient oracle from the north of Europe. If you have any questions or want to participate in today's program, sign in and join us in the chat room at blogtalkradio.com. Now, back to the program.
Hi, and thanks for joining us. My name's John Carosella, and I'm your host for Convergence on Firefly Willows, LIVE. So, in the roundtable, we talked about resistance. And we're going to get back to resistance a little later in the program. Resistance, adversity, obstacles, and what that all means and how to make some sense out of it. But for the moment, I want to share an experience with you that I had at the last full moon. I have the privilege of going to Northern California with a friend of mine, almost to the Oregon border. And we do healing work on the land up there. And it's a very beautiful experience. And this one place that we go, there is a magnificent, very, very old grandmother oak. We think that she's probably at least 400 years old and probably much older. She has a really fascinating shape because she has a big, bulky trunk, which is obviously really old because it's as big around as a good-sized redwood tree. And yet there is this slender and graceful growth that comes out of the top of that. And, you know, these branches, these limbs that are growing up out of this really bulky trunk are themselves probably, I don't know, 200 years old or more. So it's not like they're saplings. But there's a very significant difference between the bulky trunk and the graceful limbs. And it just you look at her and it's just a little odd. And I found myself wondering, what is the nature of the personality that has lived her life? I mean, clearly she had a long, full life doing what oak trees do, growing and looking beautiful and getting bigger and bigger. And then something happened, some tragedy, where a whole bunch of her broke off. Maybe she was struck by lightning or a big windstorm. And, you know, who knows how long ago that was, 200, 300 years ago. And, you know, you get the sense of, wow, that must have been a terrible, painful tragedy. And then somehow, slowly and without rancor, without judgment, she began a process of rebuilding, of re-engaging with life. So here's this being that has deep, deep memories around very new, well, relatively new, but certainly newer, graceful vitality. So in the presence of this something not matching to my eyes, I brought to mind a D.H. Lawrence quote. I never saw a wild thing sorry for itself. And in that moment, I saw the maiden in the crone. And the moon rose, coming up behind another big, beautiful oak tree. And this oak tree, her leaves weren't out yet, so the moon shone through, and wow, it was beautiful. This last full moon was at perigee, the closest approach of the moon to the earth, and so it was especially large in the night sky. And the sky at the horizon had just that right kind of thin clouds and haze that the sky all around the moon was bathed in a showy display of white gold moonlight and lace. It was just beautiful. And I stood there, and I felt the moonlight on my face. You know, I think we don't get enough moonlight. My friend Meg Beeler said that once, and I agree. We evolved over millions of years under the moon. We know that if we don't get enough sunlight, we suffer from a vitamin D deficiency. So what happens when we don't get enough moonlight? Do we know? I felt the moonlight on my face. I felt the air against my skin. And I felt my feet in the spongy grass. And I felt the great mother that is this earth alive. And I got a sense of scale. The enormousness of the planet became clear. The gigantic tree beside me, so cozy and so small compared to the hills into which she was nestled. The hills, so small compared to the terrain that they were nestled in. The terrain, so small compared to the weather systems, the big masses of clouds that flow past year after year, century after century. And all the time breathing the night air, soaked in the moonlight. I thought of my lungs. I felt them. And I felt the exchange of air. And I thought of the tiny alveoli that did the work inside me. And I saw suddenly these grand, magnificent trees as the tiny alveoli of the earth, of this marvelous, wondrous living being, this living system that is our planet. The scale, tree to planet, alveolus to person, is almost the same. And I thought of how the trees don't do their work alone. I thought about the great communities of algae and phytoplankton in the oceans also do this very precious, very intimate work. And I thought about how on a very grand scale, we're all connected, breathing in and breathing out. And I thought about how and why we don't actually feel connected in this way. You know, we're a culture obsessed with our own thoughts and creations. We're obsessed with essentially our own sorcery. We create objects out of matter. We create institutions out of concepts and corporations out of one another. And then we turn them on each other and on ourselves, and we consume one another. And we consume the world around us. We indulge ourselves. We gorge ourselves on our own creations, whether it's iPads or TV or superhighways or fancy ensuite bathrooms. Somehow, without thought for the limits or for the carrying capacity of our beautiful little blue spaceship. But it all comes from somewhere, and it all has to go back to somewhere. Where? Breathing in and breathing out under the moonlight, I was reminded of Julia Butterfly Hill, who courageously tree-sat in an ancient redwood for 2 years. That was back in the late 90s. And in an interview later, I heard her say, "Where is away? When you decide to throw something away, where is that?" Well, there is no away. There's only here, my backyard, my home, my place where I exist. Everything comes from and everything goes back to my home. Why do we resist this truth? Are we such children that we don't know about cleaning up after ourselves? Do we think it's somebody else's responsibility, somebody else's job to clean up after us? Well, yes, we do. Mother Earth has typically done a great job of cleaning up after her children. After all, it's built into the system. Just like when the body cleanses and restores and purges itself. When we're sick, like I was a few weeks ago, something it clearly is up, something's amiss. We can say there's an imbalance. My lungs and sinuses were really congested, a mess, and I ached all over. And it lasted a while. I could sense that my body was trying to right itself and to bring things back into balance. But were things out of balance? Well, in a way, no. They were out of balance for me, certainly out of my comfort zone, but the grand mechanisms of life, of energy exchange, of sow and reap, plant and harvest, were still grandly at work, just as they were out under the full moon, just as they were when Grandmother Oak suffered her tragedy. The only thing was, my consciousness wasn't too happy with the way things were working out. I was aware of that which didn't feel good. My body, directed by my spirit, didn't want to make room for those various energies that were the viruses and bacteria and whatever all else that were trying to colonize me. So we, my body and I, applied ourselves to the process of getting back into harmony within me, my version of harmony. Perhaps in the same way that the crone transcended herself, expanded herself, and transformed herself to embody the maiden again. And I think this is where we get to an interesting vista point. When we look at what is out of balance in our world, we have to ask, out of balance from what perspective? It all depends on what we value, and perhaps on what we feel. If we value biodiversity and long-term sustainability, we see balance one way. If we value pop culture, desperate housewives, and super big gulps, if we value indulging ourselves in our own creations, then we see it in another. Fair enough. Then I guess the question becomes, why would we value one over the other? Why does one of us value one way and another the other way? And maybe here is where it gets interesting. Certainly, if we only ever have exposure to one, then the other doesn't even come into our thinking, into our perception. We don't know any better. We don't know any other. We don't know what we're missing. And when we don't know what we're missing, when we really don't have a way to embrace the true nature of our reality, in this case, this world, this planet, this living system, we can, indeed we will, find ourselves in a place where things are hard, painfully hard. Obstacles will seem to appear everywhere we look, because we're not looking through clear eyes. We're looking at the map, not the terrain. And the map is a map of our own creation, loaded with flaws and misconceptions and signs that say, there be dragons here. Of course the world isn't going to work in a friendly, benign way when we're trying to use it in the wrong way. It's like, imagine how uncomfortable you'd be trying to use your car as a submarine. It looks, kind of on the surface, like it should work, right? It's got a compartment, a cabin, you're inside something. It has a way of making itself go. And we force and we force and we force. And because we're very clever, we make a certain kind of headway. And the way we use our resources and ourselves seems to be successful, especially when we expend so much energy insulating ourselves from the parts of our behavior that actually generates the bad stuff, the disease and the dysfunction. And whenever that unsavory stuff seeps in, we've invented ways, we always have options to numb ourselves to it. Through distractions like TV and Facebook, drugs and alcohol, to blaming the other guy, the other religion, the other political party. It all makes perfect sense in a crazy kind of twisted logic. We're doing the clever thing to try to control our world and make ourselves comfortable. I guess in a way I'm seeking to ease and dissolve my inclination to assign blame. Because blame is just a way of feeling sorry for ourselves. Who are we blaming for things gone wrong? In the end, we humans, we're wild things too. Untamed, unplanned, undisciplined, unaware. If only we would all read the owner's manual of our beautiful blue spaceship. How do we do that? I think we choose to feel. To feel what's really out there, what's really happening, especially that which is uncomfortable. We have to reconnect with the body that sustains us and feel enough of her pain that we understand. Hopefully we can understand her pain, and that her pain is our pain too. Take a hand of someone who doesn't know. Walk with them into the alveoli of the earth. Ask them what they want to reap and what hopes they have for their grandchildren. Talk about what you're resisting and about what's uncomfortable and why. Explain that there is no away. In the end, I think there is no one to blame. There is no correct path. There is only the path we choose. We'll be right back.
Firefly Willows is excited to announce the Magical Roots of Reiki. Participants in this workshop will explore the esoteric knowledge hidden within Reiki, delve deep into its mystical source, and experience firsthand the power that powers Reiki. Join us July 2012 as we host Jose Figueroa Garcia, Director of Natural Therapies of Oslo, Norway. Jose will lead this workshop on amplifying the power of Reiki by understanding its esoteric roots. Visit fireflywillows.com for more details.
Welcome back to Convergence on Firefly Willows, LIVE. My guest today is Ana Maria Sanchez. Ana Maria holds a master's degree in counseling psychology and is a holistic counselor. She is the founder of Free the Light Within, which you can find online at freethelightwithin.com. Ana Maria worked for 10 years within the San Mateo County Office of Special Education and the Mental Health Department, specifically with the special needs and probationary population. Within that period, her duties ranged from substitute teacher's aide to case manager, counselor, and then bilingual therapist. Ana Maria has since transitioned from that role and has gone on to embrace all forms of spiritual and personal development in order to release herself from her own pain and lack of self-worth. She's now an empowerment counselor, a licensed Louise Hay Heal Your Life educator, and a workshop facilitator, published author, and speaker. Welcome, Ana Maria.
Thank you for having me, John.
It's great to see you. It's a delight to have you on the show. We've known each other for about a year and a half now.
Easy.
And you've always been kind of an inspiring person for me. And I think that has a lot to do with the terrain that you have walked. And I'd like you to share a little bit about that terrain. But before we go into that, there is something that, you know, you have a mission. It's very clear that you are excited about and empowered by this mission that you have. Tell us about that.
Not about the train, more the mission.
The mission first, then we'll talk about the train.
Well, I feel that because of the path that I walked once before, prior to me getting onto the spiritual path, with my experience there and the deep depression I experienced in that area, because I have the tools and resources now, it is my duty to go forward and to help others and to share the resources I now have. And it's something bigger than me, because I did begin with that idea to go forward and be a counselor, look for the position that you do after you graduate from college and get into the agencies and the communities and the system. But it became even bigger than that when I had my own dark night of the soul. And then once I was able to evolve out of that, crawl my way out of that, I should say, was the calling, the calling to reach for higher consciousness and to help others do the same, bring them up there with me as well. Not to say that I've achieved that fully now, but I know that when I fall, I have the tools and skills to get back up pretty quickly as opposed to the decades it took to figure it even out.
Mm. So you've written a book.
Mm-hmm.
The title of the book is?
Girl from the Hood Gone Good.
I love that title.
Thank
it's
you.
Awesome. But there's a subtitle.
Yes. One Woman's Mission to Help Others Overcome a Pain-Filled Past.
So you are helping others, and is that the mission?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so you've had a pain-filled past. And, you know, I've read a bunch of your book, and we've mm-hmm. talked. And it seems like for a lot of the time that you were growing up and into your adulthood, you were kind of living in a nightmare.
Yeah, I was. I was leading a double life as well. I mean, it definitely was a nightmare, but I got so conditioned and used to it, I didn't know any other way. But I knew there was another way. I personally was not aware of it because my life was so chaotic and in a conditioned state and habitual, especially with my personal addictions. But also, that's why I took up psychology, was to find that way that people always talk about that will get you out of the way that I was leading my life.
So let's talk a little bit about the terrain. What was going on?
Well, at a young age, my life began, I would say around 6 years old is my first memory, but things are surfacing now from the book, from my family, that things were starting way before that age, say around 2 years old. But at 6 years old was my first memory of the sexual abuse. And that pretty much sealed and stamped how my life was going to be for quite some time. Because by the age of 11, I was really out of control with the drinking. And at that age, I was smoking marijuana and the boys. And by 13, 14, harder drugs, and got into a deeper relationship by 15 for 10 years, which was extremely violent. It was brutal. But I was a victim in many cases, but at the same time, I learned to become the perpetrator myself. Because two things happen in those kind of relationships. You take the kicks and the punches, and you stay down, or you learn how to fight and rock and roll with it. And I basically actually became just as abusive as my abuser and just as violent. It was pretty it was very surreal to observe that in myself.
I can imagine. And I want to touch on this just a little bit more. When did you realize that you were, you say you started acting out a lot when you got into your preteens.
Yeah, 11.
What, did you have a sense of what was happening to you?
No. Let's see. I felt empowered. I felt angry. But that anger, I translated into a sense of empowerment and confidence. I didn't have the emotional maturity or the articulation, the words to understand or the content with which to understand what was happening to me. I just knew by the age of 11 that I thought of myself as a woman. I am a woman now. And I'm not going to take anyone's crap.
So in a way you were claiming yourself.
Yeah.
But for some reason you claimed yourself in a way that led you to certainly independent behavior, but also self-destructive behavior. Can you reflect on that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, in retrospect, it had a lot to do with the lack of self-worth and the immense amount of self-hatred I had and having no one to guide me. There were people in my family that were willing to guide me, but my mom, I believe, was very protective. And, well, I think that had to do with the shame, right?
Mm.
And her famous quote to this day is, everything is fine. Everything is fine. When evidently everything around you is falling apart. So I was flailing around to try to find my place. Because
Did you feel shame?
Oh, yeah. I remember, yes, absolutely. I can actually see it, envisioning it right now. I felt a lot of shame, disgust. It was my fault, I would think. And I started acting out with all the other kids on the block. What was being done to me, I turned around and started doing to others on the block.
Do you think that the other kids and other adults, as you went through this period, do you think they also felt some kind of shame?
Yeah. In talking to many, many survivors of this, incest or molestation of all kinds or just physical abuse, all of us across the board, if you read the research, if you've had a chance to talk to anyone who's gone through this, shame is huge.
And so there's the shame thing. is a really powerful field that you get locked into, I think. Is that right?
Yeah.
And so is that why you focus on self-love so much?
Absolutely. Because that is a complete opposite of the shame. The shame is telling you that you're worthless. Repeating those tapes and enforcing that belief system that, you know, your value is less than zero, whereas self-love is quite the opposite.
What is the path from shame to self-love?
There's quite a few steps, and the first one is the awareness. It's the awareness, having the awareness that, wow, things aren't working out, and the awareness that when you start to realize there's so much negativity going on throughout your day in your head, there's a whole conversation, a committee up there telling you you can't. What we want to put up there is the cheerleaders that say, yay, you can, and override the naysayer. So the first step would be becoming aware that you're out of alignment, or simply that you're depleted and exhausted from the mind that keeps going on and on and on with all these negative thoughts. And then wanting to do something about it.
And how do you, I mean, it seems like an obvious thing to realize that you're depleted, that you're exhausted. But how do you know that it, like, what was your way, your experience of realizing that, oh, I'm depleted and exhausted because of these tapes that are running in my head? How did you come to that?
Well, it wasn't just the psychology courses I was taking, because I was in denial during that period, obviously. Taking psychology courses and being in these universities while the whole time being in abusive relationships, doing drugs and drinking to oblivion all night long. So what it took for me was, I'll be honest with you, someone in a bar had said to me after I had a physical altercation with my partner at that time, and the guy said, Anna, you must not like yourself at all. And I thought he was the craziest drunk in town, because I'm like, right, I am so popular, I know all the right people, we go to all the right parties, yada, 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 all the things that I thought gave my life meaning and identity. But I went home thinking about that, and it haunted me. It really haunted me when he said, you must not like yourself very much. And that to me was like, what are you talking about? Of course I do. Oh, this spat that me and my boyfriend had and that little fist fight you just saw, that ain't nothing. And then that's what started probing me to really start assessing and looking at myself going, but just because that happens doesn't mean I don't love myself. God, I go to psychology classes. I'm going to be a counselor. Obviously, I love myself. But that one little statement, I got called out on it, basically.
Well, the reason I'm poking on this is because I think self-love is, we often delude ourselves into thinking that we love ourselves.
Absolutely.
And that we respect ourselves and so on, but we don't always. And I'm curious, because I realized something about myself too. It's like one day I realized, oh, dude, you don't respect yourself. You don't respect all the labor and the effort that you apply. You treat it like it's tissue paper. And I to this day, I'm trying to figure out, how come I didn't see that? How come we don't see our lack of self-respect?
Well, I think because, you know, environment is stronger than willpower. You're running around with a majority of people that feel the very same way you do. So it's that conditioning. It's the reinforcement of that. So you're running with people that have the same belief system in a sea of illusion. How are you not going to be able, how are you going to be able to see the clarity there?
Right. So if you're in a sea of illusion, then it's kind of hard to figure out what's real. And so, yeah, I guess the illusions dominate in that case. So there's this double life that you were leading is probably the most riveting part to me. And you don't go into a lot of detail about it in the book. But it seems so impossible that you could have been such a driven student, such a driven professional, you know, on a professional track, and also have been still caught in this whirlwind of craziness, nightmarishness. How did you reconcile that? How did you function?
You know, people ask me that all the time, and I think while I was going through all that, leading that double life, I didn't really realize it was a double life in that moment. You know, I was just doing what it took to survive. I was unwilling to leave the hood, my friends, my identity, basically. And I had a real strong sense of loyalty to the people and to where I come from. Like street cred, right? You know, which was much stronger. But I also had a thirst and a hunger for knowledge. I've always been that way. And that comes from my father. Because my father was going to get his degrees, his master's, and he was doing his PhD at that time as well. He would take me at a very young age, you know, first through third grade. I remember in third grade reading eighth grade books and beginning to buy all, it was called Dynamite Magazine back then.
I remember that magazine.
Yeah. Early 70s. My parents let me order every single book each quarter, and I read them all. And they were all different stories, right? They had all kind of, I wanted them all, and I got them all. So that was instilled in me. So that was normal. So was the dysfunction that came later. So it was easy for me to lead those two lives because those were two of my identities.
But actually, they weren't really two identities to you.
No.
See, I think that's the key, right? Is and this is a fascinating sketch, right? Because living the way you were living, you weren't living two lives. To us, to an outside observer, she's living two lives. But to you, they were seamless.
Yeah, perfect, seamless, perfect word. Yeah.
And that's so. I'm thinking about this because I'm thinking about how, you know, if you realized you were leading two lives, then you probably could have the sense of contrast and say, oh, well, this is this and that is that, and these two things don't go together. But if you are so connected to, and we all are, connected to our behaviors, then there really isn't a dichotomy. It's all one thing. And so extracting yourself from that is a lot harder, you know, because it's not, wow, that's very interesting. That's
Thank you. I think.
Yes, you're a very interesting person. That's a compliment. Okay, so self-love. How do you share that with people? How do you help people find self-love?
Well, the tool, I use them with the a lot of different techniques I've learned along the way and tools. And getting licensed through the Heal Your Life practitioner training, which is through Patricia and Rick Crane. And they were the students to Louise Hay, and she ordained the program. And here we are with the licensing. It's wonderful.
So what is the nature of the Louise Hay work?
Well, you know, many have called her the guru of self-love and affirmations. But before even Louise Hay was doing this, right, the positive thought theory has been in place for quite some time. She has packaged it in such a way that it is easily readable and it touches your heart quickly. It is so simple yet so profound. And her work is really based on the mirror work exercises as well as affirmations. And affirmations are a positive statement made in the present time as if it's already happening. You know, one of mine was before, 3 years ago I started off, it was, I am a gifted and powerful healer. Many come to me and pay gladly my full service fee. Wasn't happening then, but it is now.
That's fantastic.
I think I was getting love offerings then. And love offerings, for those who don't know, can be anywhere from a dollar to 20, 25. You know, someone's feeling really generous, it's different, but things have changed. Things have definitely shifted since.
So you've applied the tools and they've worked for you.
Yes. I take many of those tools along with what I have learned in my clinical psych training and as well as my personal life experiences. So for me, what I do with students or one-on-one clients is I implement mirror work, journal writing, emphasize being out in nature, doing the talk therapy and doing a lot of processes there, inner child work, looking at where these tapes began, having them do a, so all this is about self-discovery. And once you have that self-discovery, the awareness begins and the ahas begin to happen, and then you know where you need to go into in that part of your psyche, that part of your mind, that part of your being that needs to be re-scripted.
Tell us about the mirror work.
Extremely powerful and the number one thing that all my students and clients avoid. And I was much like that, too. When I was going to psychotherapy several years ago, I still continue to go to guidance, and I will never give up on being a seeker and staying on top of my game, so to speak. But when I was in psychotherapy about 8 years ago, they did not coin it the Louise Hay, you know, the mirror work. She was just trying to get me to look in the mirror and say that I loved myself. I love Anna. I love you, Anna. I love you, Anna. And I could not for the life of me do it. What I wanted to do was break that mirror into and shatter it into pieces. I had no idea that the amount of rage and disgust towards myself was so prevalent. Because I look in the mirror every day, right? But
right.
Put on your makeup, get ready to go out. That never comes up. But to sit still and to tell yourself, I love you, Anna, that was very difficult. I couldn't do it.
Why?
So I obviously didn't, I had the rage towards myself. I hadn't forgiven myself. I had so much shame still. That was very telling. A lot of self-loathing, which, mind you, I had no idea was to that depth. I had done so much work up to that point. We're looking at 2004, right? I had done so much work, and here it was again, but we were going deeper, and the mirror work beckons you to go deeper. So when I couldn't do it, I came into her office, and she made me do it in front of her in a mirror. And I kid you not, and I always use this phrase, but it was the truth, I was in fetal position. It was the most, I felt like I was just cracked open. And it was so painful to have that amount of awareness pour in.
And what was cracked open?
I would say my spirit. My very being.
Was it a shell of, was it like a protective shell that cracked open?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so then suddenly something was exposed that had not been exposed and was hypersensitive to the environment?
I had always known, I mean, not always, but when I started my journey on getting help, psychological help, mental help, and spiritual, I had been looking at this area already. But there were gentler tools, apparently. Because this mirror work was just out of this world, and it took about 6 weeks for me to be able to begin to do it on my own, and little by little, and I do it to this day now, but that is the main thing, and that is the one that's resisted the most, but I get it, because I too resisted it, and then got broken open in my therapist's office, and then from there began the real journey to really look at myself with love. And that's literal, right? You're looking in the mirror, dropping into your heart, tapping into your soul, and accepting yourself and looking at yourself as your creator would.
And what does that feel like?
Really, really delicious. Yummy. It's a really nice feeling. And honestly, there are times when I get into my little cycle of negativity, and I realize after a week, oh boy, I haven't done any of the tools that I tell my students and clients to do. And then I start applying them, and how quickly I'm able to get out of my head and back into that place, heart-centered place.
So using the tools regularly, it's not like you use the tools to get yourself out of crisis and then you're done.
Oh no, this is forever a journey. This is forever something that needs to be implemented. It's like if you want to stay fit, right? Which is an area I'm ignoring right now.
It's been rainy.
Yeah. you have to stay on top of that. You have to go consistently to keep that body in shape, and you have to consistently go and do check-ins with a counselor if you want to keep your mind, and if you want to keep your spirit in check, you're going to be doing these spiritual techniques. And it's just a way to uplift your soul and keep you there, because we are bombarded every day with such negativity, the news, society. It's just a lot to take in for our psyches. So we have to counterbalance that, you know, and allow in the beauty and the words and the thoughts that are going to bring us to an elated state, or at least keep us in balance throughout the days. So it's consistent. This is consistent, because if you don't practice, then it's going to fall by the wayside, and then you find yourself back where you were, if not in a worse position, or if you don't do this at all, it escalates. It gets worse and worse and worse.
Where do people? Maybe some examples where people discover or confront or encounter the negative reinforcement. Because what I then want to do is ask, okay, how do you counteract those, you know, in that situation? So where do people find themselves confronted with negative reinforcement?
In their homes, in their own homes, within their own family systems. It's sad to say, but it's a reality, because there's dysfunction there that many people in a family system do not reach out and go get the psychological help, mental, spiritual help they could benefit from. So the cycle continues. So even in your own home, you're going to find that dysfunction repeating. So you stay in that mode until you realize nothing here is going to change. Only I am going to change. Therefore, what am I going to do? Who am I going to turn to? Or what books am I going to read? Or what techniques can I gain to break this cycle?
And so it's a process of being the catalyst for change, being your own catalyst for change.
Yeah, and that's the only place you can really do it, right? Is with yourself, you know.
And
then share it with others. And then once you become that role model and people see something's happening, a change is happening, they get curious and want to know, how did you do it and what's going on? And then it becomes infectious.
So do people, I mean, it's, okay, how do, when you begin to make change in yourself, in the presence of negative reinforcement in your own home, what happens?
Oh, a few things happen. There can be total opposition from the family itself, because you're switching up the game and no one likes change. So you can get a lot of throw up, I'll say, from your own family members. Because if you're changing, that's going to change the dynamic of that family system. And you're starting to stir up their having to look at their stuff. And that's not going to be comfortable for people who are resistant to becoming aware of that, because that would mean work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also, you can get support. And if you get the support, you reap the benefits much quicker, because everyone starts to fall into place and want to be in alignment and in balance, and starts looking at their own roles in this system.
And is there a way to cultivate that support? Is there a way to sort of program that experience for success in your home when you have when you are the catalyst?
Well, the support would come from going out and, again, environment stronger than willpower. If you're not going to get the support at home, then reach out and start going to places that you are going to get that support, so you can still stand as that beacon in the home. Because if you get all that opposition, you're going to need the support. You're going to need people to stand behind you as you go back into that situation.
And the environment is stronger than willpower. Mm-hmm. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, for me, you know, I'm in recovery, trying to be, I should say. It's been quite a daunting task, to be honest, because everywhere I go, there's alcohol, right? It doesn't matter if I'm with healers, if I'm with, you know, the more elite crowd, or if I'm with colleagues, or if I'm with people from the hood. It is everywhere. So for me, I always thought I was strong enough with the spiritual tools that I have. But that's not necessarily so, because if I'm sitting there with everyone, tribes and tribes and tribes and tribes of people from different tribes having cocktails, because many of them are normies, right? To them, they don't have a problem. So how am I going to be able to withstand staying in my sobriety if I can perpetually keep myself in those environments? I have to find the environment that's going to be conducive to my healing. And that's been a huge aha to me, because I thought my spirituality and my will alone was going to help me overcome this. But, you know, this is a disease. This is something much bigger than me. Therefore, I must, if I plan on continuing to be with healers, be with people that are going to help me open up the doors, which are colleagues at these business networking events, I have to accept there's going to be alcohol there. I cannot remove myself. But what I can do is balance that by finding my tribe of sober people and find that balance. And I just found that aha out a few weeks ago, realizing to myself, I don't want to hang out with anyone that's really, really sober, that has no cocktails whatsoever. Yeah. And I don't even mean sober, because people I hang out with, a lot of people are not, they don't have a problem. But cocktail is the way that our society relaxes and socializes and celebrates.
So you want to find a place where people relax and socialize and celebrate without alcohol.
Yeah, I need to.
You need to.
I need to find that balance.
And would you say that that's, is that a fundamental tool of crafting your environment for your own health, regardless of what your situation is?
Absolutely.
So find places where joy and celebration can happen in a way that's in alignment and with you and constructive for your growth.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I'm aiming to do, and it's going to happen because I'm now more determined than ever. You know, as an alcoholic, we play many games with ourselves, make many allowances, think that will somehow cure the situation. I've tried everything, you know, and it's daunting and it's overwhelming and it gets disheartening, because the only one that I'm defeating is myself. Complete abstinence is what is needed, you know, and that is something that I've done before. I was able to do for a couple of years, and now I find myself, because my business is growing, because the credibility from the book, and because I'm out there much more,
many more encounters with the things that are not good for you.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, it's not that it's not good for the people serving it, because we're at these nice gatherings, but I have to now really tighten up ship there. Yeah.
And your spiritual tools help you.
Yes. Yes.
What are some of those tools?
Prayer. On my knees and pray. For me, it's journal writing, and also self-disclosure, being very candid and open and honest about where I'm at in my life and on this journey with my friends, with my family, outing myself, not holding these secrets, outing myself, asking for help. And that is a huge tool. First thing for me upon waking is prayer. And then it's having an assessment of my day and mind it by a couple friends who are supportive and I see as role models and that are my mentors and encourage me, as well as being my friends that understand my struggles. But the main thing there, my spiritual tool, is outing myself.
Okay.
You know?
So we're going to take a short break.
Sure.
And then I want to come back and talk a little bit more about self-disclosure.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll be right back.
We'll be back with more spirited conversation between John and Ana Maria Sanchez after this short break.
Welcome back. My guest is Ana Maria Sanchez of Free the Light Within and author of Girl from the Hood Gone Good. So, Ana Maria, just before the break, you were talking about the tools that you use to reinforce your good path, your alignment. And you said self-disclosure. And I kind of want to dig into that a little bit, because self-disclosure and shame don't go together very well.
Exactly.
So what does it take? How do you choose to self-disclose? Why do you choose to self-disclose? And how do you overcome the resistance?
For me, I chose to self-disclose because in 2002, when I was working for the county, and that was by then my 10th year, many different roles I played, you know, from substitute teacher's aide and worked my way up. So I achieved the highest level that I could have got to, and then everything came crashing down around me.
Why did it come crashing down?
I just got deeper into the drinking and drugs.
Self-sabotage. So, okay.
And here I was working with kids at juvenile hall, telling them not to do this, yet I was knee-deep in it. No, actually, neck-deep in it. I started having that break within myself that was like, wow, Anna, you're really walking a really hypocritical line. My spirit was begging me to stop, look, and listen. How can you be sitting here telling them how to live their lives, and these poor kids are getting thrown into jail for the very same thing that you're doing and getting away with? So I left that position and slept for a year. And when I woke up, I was so effing fed up with Anna and all her bullshit and all her lies and all. It took so much energy to bullshit, you know. It just does. That from that day forward, I just started copying and outing myself on everything, because that's also a way for me to hold myself accountable and to be, have others look at me with accountability. Not with judgment, but just simply like, okay, you're telling us all this for a reason, I hope, right? There's got to be a point to all this.
Well, it is interesting because did it feel like you were shaming yourself in public?
Back then, probably. I didn't feel that, but I think it was probably the martyr, right? The lashing yourself with, you know, the leather on your back over and over to become saintly. But that's part of the shaming myself.
Hmm.
I did not know it was going to lead to something so cathartic and healing and be exemplary for others to follow. At that time, I was outing myself because it was part of the sabotage. It was part of the, like, you ain't shit, you know. Here you are, put it out there. But at the same time, what it became later was something that I could not even have even conceived, which was something that was very healing, very needed. And others are now going, wow, if you can self-disclose and you're walking this path of spirituality and you're calling out your flaws and showing up with your humanness, then it's an okay thing to do. You still live. You still survive it.
Well, so this is the other piece, right? On the one hand, it can appear as self-shaming because you are, in a sense, saying the uncomfortable things about yourself that you don't want to have to say.
Mm-hmm.
And so that feels like, well, the sooner I can stop saying these things about myself, the better. But it's also an exercise in being vulnerable,
yeah,
and surviving, right? Yeah, I said all these things about myself. I told everybody that this was who I am, and I'm still here. And what does that do for you?
It reminds me, it affirms to me that my mission must be completed. That they're, you know, God, the universe, cosmos, benevolent guides, all of that, Mother Earth, Gaia, all of it, have a purpose for me. I must complete that mission. Keep on keeping on.
Mm. And that mission is, again?
To be of service to others by using my story as an example for them to understand that you can and will overcome your emotional past that has kept you stunted and in so much grief. But there are tools, and I know those tools, to help you get out from under.
So who are your clients? Who comes to you?
Primarily women, but I do have men. It's growing. It's pretty neat to watch how many come to the meetups and how many come to the classes now and how many sit before me one-on-one in my sessions. They're all coming because they are not comfortable with themselves. They're sad. They're trying to figure out what's the sadness about. They're making a lot of money in a really good job, yet they're sad. And some are coming from broken marriages or broken childhoods, but why are they so sad? They want a solution. They want a solution. They want answers. They want a solution. They want to lead healthier, happier lives. And by the time they come to me, they're willing to do the work and they are asking for the tools and skills to be able to go forward. And what I am asking from them is a commitment to follow through for at least the 90-day intensive, 3 months, and for some it's six months to a year. But to go forward, and once they know these tools, to apply them. You can know them, but keep them there like nice little treasure in a box and never look at it again, but you have to apply them.
And what happens?
Transformation happens. Shift happens. I show up with my expertise and help guide them in. They do the growth work that is assigned within when we're seeing each other face to face, and the growth work that I assign during the week we don't see each other and they come back. The journaling, the mirror work, the self-assessments, the check-ins, the keeping in contact with me, and all these tools that we have, and the universe swoops in and completes the...
Helps and fill in the blanks.
Yeah, yeah. It's a formula, and but we all have to play our role and show up. Yeah.
It's pretty exciting work, I can imagine.
Yeah, it is. It's what keeps me going, like, to see the transformations that take place within my students and clients. It's amazing. Yeah, the feedback is incredible.
So how can you tell if you're how can someone tell if they are a good candidate to come and see you?
If they find themselves depressed, if they find themselves in bed not wanting to get out, if they find themselves with these headaches, but they're not so much headaches like you would have to take an aspirin for it, but just mind aches that you know you can't shut it off. You are trying to shut off and keep saying, "Oh, I just don't need to think that anymore. I'm just going to stop thinking that." Really? Okay. When you find that remedy, let me know how quickly you can do it, because I have had to do so much to turn it off, so to speak. But you don't really turn off that negative mindset. What happens is you end up replacing it with something positive, and the awareness that when you see that negativity coming into your scope of
your awareness, your mindscape.
You are able to negate it and implement something positive right there. But
is that really an essential and simple tool? Like, if I have a negative thought, replace it.
Yeah, it's essential, simple. Practice. With practice, it becomes second nature.
Because it becomes habit.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting point. It's one thing to say, I'm going to stop thinking about this, and it's quite another to replace it.
Yeah.
Because replacing it actually is an active motion as opposed to a suppressive motion.
We have to look at why this is even showing up. And you're denying it doesn't mean it's going to go away. It's going to grow and fester and show up in other ways, either through odd behavior, escapism, whatever that escapism may be to you, drinking, drugs, women, men, really bad habits, obsessive habits, whatever that may be. So there's no denying it. The only way to defeat that is turn around and look at it right in the face.
Yeah, well, the going into the wound is a really, really effective, but also very challenging and difficult to do if you don't know how. Because everything that you've been taught is to not go into the wound, is to go in the other direction.
Yeah.
Okay, so what happens when people come and see you and they experience shift? What does that shift look like?
Well, they will vocalize, articulate how much better they are feeling. And then they back it up with examples. Their life is getting better. Their relationships are getting better at work with colleagues and bosses, at home with their lovers and partners, with their children. All across the board, they're seeing the benefits. So they are articulating very clearly. And when I look at them, they literally look lighter. Their whole tone of their face, the coloring, there is a lighter energy to them, which is very evident. And there has been a lifting of this heavy cloak that they have wrapped themselves around. You know, on a metaphysical level, it's been lifted. You're unraveling that.
Wow.
And it shows.
And that sounds beautiful and sounds like a good thing to do.
Give yourself 3 months, you know, and they'll tell you that. And, you know, I'm sorry, I don't abide by the, you know, 21 days become a millionaire, 21 days, you know, get flat abs. Yeah, okay, it takes, that's just the beginning, you know, for you to even pick up the books and the manuals and all that. It is about 90 days, easily, 90 days of a solid commitment before you really start seeing the changes, before they can become a lifestyle.
Yeah, I think that's really important to emphasize that you're talking about changing habit,
mm-hmm.
and changing habit just takes time. And, you know, it's like wine. You can be as as aggressive and as smart and as capable as anybody, but you know what? Once the wine gets in the barrel, it's got to sit, and you can't rush it. And so there are certain things in life that you can't rush. You have to absorb at the rate in which they are naturally absorbed. And changing habits, kind of one of those ways.
Correct. Yeah.
So any other thoughts, any last words, or anything you want to share with our listeners?
Well, if they want to hear more about my services or read more about my services or find the book, they can go to my website.
FreeTheLightWithin.com. Mm-hmm.
And they can download for free Chapter 4 and get a taste of what the book is about. Down on that, my website as well, FreeTheLightWithin.com, there is an MP3 they can download that's from Louise Hay that they can get for free on all areas that they might need, love, finances, relationships, self-worth, all these affirmations and actual MP3s that will help them get through their day and help give them inspiration.
Okay. Well, Ana Maria Sanchez, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, John.
We'll talk again
soon. It's been fun.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
We hope you're enjoying this broadcast of Firefly Willows LIVE on Blog Talk Radio. For information on Firefly Willows, please explore our website, fireflywillows.com. Or like us on Facebook.
Welcome back to Convergence. I'm John Carosella. Well, Ana Maria, wow, that was quite an interview, huh? She's got an amazing story. And it's a story that is full of challenge and adversity and resistance. So I want to talk a little bit more about that. I think we all deal with a lot of that in our lives. We struggle with how to understand and navigate adversity. Now, there is a rune. The runes are an ancient alphabet and an oracle that came to us from the Norse. It's said that Odin, the great all-father, god, deity, man, warrior of the Norse, hung from the Tree of Life for 9 days and 9 nights, upside down. And at the end of that time, he looked into the pool of water that was beneath him, and he spied the runes, and he took them up. And there are 24 runes, and there's a poem that Odin wrote that describes each. And the one that I want to talk about today is called Nautes. Nautes is the rune of necessity and constraint, pain and limitation. Now, that might sound like a downer, but the truth is, this rune is very informative, and it gives us a lot of help in dealing with adversity, constraint, pain, and limitation, because it enlightens and it illuminates what the nature of those experiences in our lives actually are, what they're for, and how they can serve us. So I'm going to reference two books. One is Taking Up the Runes by Diana Paxson, and the other is The Book of Runes by Ralph Blum. Diana Paxson, in Taking Up the Runes, describes Nautes as
the force of fate, which can bring opportunity or doom. How you experience this rune depends on how willing and able you are to face the facts of your life and make changes. Well, that's pretty powerful stuff, just on the face of it. The force of fate that can bring opportunity or doom depending on how willing and able you are to face the facts of your life. That's a pretty fierce challenge. Now, the one thing that I've noticed about the runes in working with them and studying them is that they are full of challenge. I mean, the world of Northern Europe at the time the runes were brought into this world was a pretty challenging place. And as we know from the lore of the Vikings, they were a pretty challenging people. So it's not surprising that their oracle would bring forth the color and character of their amazing world. So Naltese is a pretty tough rune among a pretty challenging oracle. So let's contemplate this a little bit. Again, from Diana Paxson's book, she offers the Norwegian rune poem for contemplation. Naltese, need leaves little choice. The naked man is chilled by frost. Well, there you go. The circumstances are one of severe limitation and constraint. The man is naked, and it's cold out. And so, oftentimes we feel and find ourselves in places where we're confronted by metaphorically the exact same situation. We're naked and it's cold. She goes on to talk about, she says, the concept of need in this rune seems to resemble the Greek concept of anake, or necessity. Its root involves concepts of constraint and narrowing. It is the factors in life that cannot be escaped that define the kinds of action that can take place. Now, this kind of situation, these kinds of constraints, can have a creative function. And it suggests that one way to deal with Naltese or with necessity is to use it to identify our own deepest needs and purposes, to find out who we really are. Paxson writes, those who succeed in life are those who have learned how to separate their life work out from all other possibilities, to focus their energies, and to work with the natural constraints and structures of the medium they choose. The birth gifts of Naltese are those inner necessities that will give shape to our lives. Now, Ralph Blum wrote the Book of Runes. Now, Ralph was a guy who brought the runes back, essentially back from the dead, repopularized them and brought them into modern culture. And he writes, the necessity of learning to deal with severe constraint is the lesson of Naltese. The role of Naltese is to identify our shadow, our dark or repressed side, places where growth has been stunted, resulting in weaknesses that are often projected onto others. Now, it's really difficult to look at the constraints, look at the limitations, look at the pain and adversity in front of us, and recognize how we have created it, how we have contributed to it, how we have manifested it. And I can't say that I've fully mastered this myself, because it does seem that there are certain circumstances in the world that are beyond my control, that are beyond the control of the innocents, so to speak. And yet I do see very often how my reactions to the circumstances of my world make matters better or worse. So just as the man naked is chilled by the frost, I too can be in circumstances where I can be cold, I can be chilled by the frost, and I can be naked, and I can choose either to be the victim and blame the weather, or dance with the circumstances, and find shelter and build a fire. Blum continues, he says, and this is actually a really powerful statement, and a statement that is unquestionably the key for me in managing through pain, limitation, and adversity. He says, don't take this world personally. Work with the shadow. Examine what it is in your nature that attracts hardship or misfortune to your life. And this is the clincher. When at last you can look upon the rune of constraint with a smile, you will recognize the troubles, denials, and setbacks of life as your teachers, guides, and allies. Okay, so that is not an easy thing to do. And I've been wrestling with this and trying to figure out a way to understand the world and a way to operate in the world that allows that to be true and allows that rune to be my friend. Because we all have our share. And I want, and I imagine you want, to turn your adversity into a resource. So here's what I did. Here's what I discovered. And you can take this thought experiment with me. Imagine you enter a room and the room is pitch black. And your objective is to walk across the room to a door on the other side. And so you begin your walk. And you get to the other side after however long it takes. You get to the other side and you open the door. What have you learned? Now let's take that same scenario. You're placed in the room. Your objective is to walk to the other side. You walk, you walk, you walk. And then you bang your arm on an obstacle, on a dresser that happens to be in the middle of the room. What have you learned? Well, one thing you've learned is that there's a dresser in the middle of the room. The other thing you've learned is that you have an arm. And I think that's really, really important, because one of the challenges that we have, in the biggest challenges that I certainly have faced, is in identifying my blind spots. And think of the blind spot, think of your blind spot as that arm that you just discovered because you banged it on the dresser. I think adversity illuminates contours of our character that we wouldn't be able to see any other way. And so instead of taking adversity personally, I actually have started to see it as a gift, as a way of the world, the universe, telling me about myself in language that I can't possibly miss. Because if it weren't so present, if it weren't so painfully attention-getting, that part of my character would remain a blind spot. Now, I don't know if this is true for every instance of adversity or every instance of pain or constraint, but I do know that when I choose to look at circumstances that way, I learn something about myself, and I make progress and I grow. And for that, I'm very grateful. The other thing that I want to mention is the notion of the map versus the terrain. One of the things that adversity and constraint brings to our attention is the discrepancy between our map and the terrain. When we walked through that room and bumped into the dresser, we discovered that our map was wrong. It didn't have the dresser on it, and so we encountered it in real life. And I think that's a really big, big lesson. We so often are in our heads. We build the world around us. We build our model of the world around us in our heads. We don't actually take the time to feel everything that is present in our environment. That's, in a way, that's what being in the moment is all about. It's being committed to embracing what is and feeling the terrain. Now, we all like to have a map because we like to be able to anticipate what's coming next. We like to be able to plan. We like to be able to leverage the nature of the terrain we're in so that we can accomplish our goals. But the problem is that so often we stop living in the terrain and start living in the map.
And then we start taking the map as if it's real. And we start blaming the world and the circumstances and the people around us when our map doesn't reveal the truth about our experience. And then we start to insulate ourselves from the world, and we start to modify our maps to include more and more antagonisms, more and more hostilities. We paint a picture of the world as if it's hostile, when in fact it's just the fact that we're not being attentive to the nature of the environment, and we're living in the map. Now, when Anna Maria and I spoke, she said, the environment is stronger than willpower. And I think you can see that the environment is actually stronger than willpower from a couple of different perspectives. From the perspective that Anna Maria was suggesting, we have to find an environment that actually supports and sustains us in the behavior and the goals that we have set for ourselves. But the other thing that I want to point out is the terrain is stronger than the map. And so if we're willing to embrace the terrain and let go of our preconceived notions that exist in the map, we can actually fall into resonance with what truly is. And the number of times that we'll be confronted by pain, limitation, and constraint will diminish. The Hindus have a deity, Ganesh. He is the Lord of Obstacles. Some people call him the remover of obstacles, but I'm not exactly sure that that's true. I think he is the Lord of Obstacles because he also places them in front of us as appropriate. We have the opportunity to see the contours of our character, to experience the nature of ourselves that we would otherwise be unable to understand or fathom when we experience obstacles, when we experience adversity. And hence, I think of adversity as a very deep and precious resource, because sometimes there isn't any other way for us to see the nature of the terrain and how it differs from our mental map and the true nature of ourselves and where we need healing than in the presence of obstacles and adversity. I hope you enjoyed today's program. I thank you for joining me. See you next time.
To learn more about today's guests or one of the topics discussed, go to fireflywillows.com/LIVE. And for more information about Firefly Willows LIVE upcoming shows, visit our page at blogtalkradio.com/FireflyWillowsLIVE. This is Deb Caracella. We hope you enjoyed the show. Join us next week when High C hosts Firefly Willows LIVE. He'll explore the philosophy and spirituality of ancient Egypt in the Kemetic Cosmos segment. During his interview with Linda Wiley, High C will discuss the deeply spiritual connection and experience that our food offers us. Then bring protection and a peaceful atmosphere to your home in magical moments, and hear what messages the oracles have to offer beneath the veil. All this and more in the next episode of Firefly Willows LIVE. Sunday, April 29th at 10:30 a.m. Pacific Time on Blog Talk Radio.